Listen, though, they were working with all these heavy metals, though. Like, I'm not unconvinced that they didn't also think they were talking to angels.
And that may very well be the case. You know, a lot of yeah. medieval alchemy was beer making. You know, so you spend the day in the lab and you're making a nice 10% IPA. And the next thing you know, you're hearing voices.
Yeah. It could happen to anyone.
You don't even realize.
I'm Paige.
And I'm Megan.
And this is Spooky Science Sisters.
Hello, you're listening to Spooky Science Sisters, a podcast where we present to you a science-based and probably very giggly discussion on all things strange and unusual. Our substitute sister for this episode is Dr. Brian Riegel, a history professor at Keene University, who has been a guest before to talk to us about the origins of cryptozoology, and who joins me today to talk about the history of alchemy and its influences on modern science. So, Brian, do you want to introduce yourself briefly again and let us know what your deal is and why you're interested in these types of topics?
Okay, my name is Brian Riegel. I'm a professor of the history of science, technology, and medicine at Keene University in New Jersey. And I write about strange stuff. I've written about monsters, I've written about pseudoscience. I've written about alchemy. I've done tons of op-ed pieces on various controversial subjects, which of course means I get tons of hate mail. And
yeah.
my latest book is called The Battle Over America's Origin Story. And it's about the tradition of legends and myths about who really discovered America.
Yeah, I think that was like on the verge of coming out, or maybe was like right. in the editing yeah. stage when we talked to you last time.
Yeah, it's actually out now. I think they've even put out a paperback edition, although they didn't tell me.
Yeah, well, we will certainly link to all of that in show notes and everything so people can find you. And the other thing to note is that you also teach a class and are currently teaching a class on the history of alchemy. So how's that going this semester?
Good, very good. It's a senior level course. And so half the students in the course are students who have taken my other classes before. So it's like old home week.
Uh-huh.
And that makes for a very enjoyable situation. The students are ready to speak and talk. And, you know, I tell yeah. really bad jokes. And
good. That's great. Okay, well, we will jump into alchemy right after we do something spooky. I will go first, so that way if you need a chance to think of anything or remember how it works. And to be fair, I don't really have anything specifically spooky that has happened to me recently, but a couple things for listeners. First, I'm very excited that the Netflix show, The Fall of the House of Usher, is coming out tomorrow. So there's a lot of hype about that. This week we get a Friday the 13th, which is always fun. So Brian, has anything spooky happened to you recently that is of note?
Nothing ever spooky ever happens to me. That's
yeah.
one of the, I have a problem on this thing that they had last week where, you know, everybody got this message on their phone.
Oh, yep.
I've had all my COVID shots and I got the message on my phone and I still haven't turned into a vampire.
Yeah.
I'm a little disappointed about that. That might have been fun.
Yeah. Yeah. It was either a vampire or like a zombie or something like that. I don't know.
We were all. It's one big tease.
Yeah. I know. And I just got the very, you know, updated shot. So I was like, ooh, I'm going to be like a super zombie. By the end of it,
zombying around all over the place.
No luck, though. Maybe next time it'll be like the end of the world predictions. It'll just sort of like move to like, oh, well, the next shot will be enough for like the 5G to kick in or whatever happens.
Well, I think like last month or the month before, the world was supposed to end.
Yes. Yeah. That was a.
It never does.
One. That we
again,
know of.
One great big tease They keep telling me the world's going to end, and I wake up, and we're all still here. And the world is still just horrible.
Yeah.
And I got to live with it.
Yeah. At this point, just bring it on.
Yeah. Just end it already.
I know. I got really excited when, like, I don't know, maybe it was within the last couple weeks, month ago or whatever, they were like, oh, there's this giant asteroid that, like, probably is going to hit Earth. And then the date was, like, I don't know, 300 years from now or something. And I was like, well, that it doesn't do me any good. Okay. So we can jump right into alchemy. I am really excited about this. You had messaged me to ask if we had talked about it before, and it's sort of been one of those things that's been on my list for a while. And specifically, well, not, I guess, not specifically, broadly, because it feels like it's sort of the definition of spooky science. Like, it's science with some weirdness blended in, like mysticism and religion and occult things going on. But I think even looking into this more, you know, I had some misunderstandings about what alchemy was and how important it actually was to, like, modern science later on. So I think you could probably do this better than I could, but do you think that you could give us, like, a general definition of what is alchemy?
Sure, I can do that. Alchemy is a complex philosophical idea that contains both practical science, particularly chemistry, and a more religious, theological, mystical aspect.
Mm-hmm.
We used to, up until about 30 years ago, alchemy was viewed by the scholarly community as this sort of strange thing that went on. And it was interesting in its way, but it really, it was a pseudoscience. So we treat it as a pseudoscience. But starting about 30 years ago or so, historians of science began to realize that it's much more complicated than that. That alchemy is, for the most part, not a pseudoscience, or was not a pseudoscience.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, we view it today as the origins of modern science.
Mm-hmm.
Chemistry, physics, metallurgy, thermodynamics, even biological evolution can be traced back to these concepts, because the whole underlying message of alchemy is change. How do you change one thing into another?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw it described frequently as sort of as a proto-science.
Yeah, that's a perfect phrase to use.
Yeah, yeah. And it's my understanding that it's centered around this idea of transformation. A lot of it focused on transformation of metals, but the idea here is that we're perfecting things. So in a lot of Western alchemy, it was like so-called base metals, like lead, could be transformed into gold, which was considered the perfect metal because it doesn't rust or tarnish, which, like, fair point. And another of the main goals here, we want to create the Philosopher's Stone, which I guess all the American Harry Potter fans would know as the Sorcerer's Stone. And that promised immortality. It could also turn other base metals into gold. They wanted to create a panacea, which would be a universal medicine that could cure any disease. And I'm not sure if this comes later. It seemed like maybe it did, but ultimately there was this idea, or maybe with some, there was this idea that you could, like, transform and perfect, like, the human soul and body. Fair enough?
Yeah, that's about right.
Yeah.
What's interesting about this is the way that the goals of alchemy change over time.
Okay.
We think that sort of the basic aspects of this comes out of India, China. There are some passages in the Hindu Vedas that lead some to think that they're talking about changing metals from one metal into another. The same sort of thing is in some very early writings out of China that talked about the relationship of gold and even extending life and medical cures.
Mm-hmm.
What I find really fascinating is that within Indian Hinduism, Buddhism, There are some references to transmutation of base metals into more valuable ones, but there isn't really, in these early stages, there really isn't that kind of mystical aspect.
Okay.
In part because in India, for example, they already believe in reincarnation.
Yeah.
So why bother to go through all this rigmarole to extend your life when we already have that covered?
Yeah.
And so that really becomes a thing when the Western Abrahamic religions start to get a hold of this.
Mm-hmm.
But it's early on, this is all about practical work.
Mm-hmm.
Changing the color of metals, melting things into a liquid so you could then pour it into a mold and make something out of it. And so the early thinkers about this thing, which will eventually become alchemy, it's all very practical.
Mm-hmm.
Actually, there's very little mystical aspect at all.
Yeah.
It's not really until, say, the 13th, 14th, 15th centuries that all that sort of magic-y stuff comes along.
Okay.
And that's when the kind of parallel philosophy to alchemy, which is Hermeticism.
Okay.
That's when these two things get intertwined.
Okay, gotcha.
And that's when the whole perfecting of the soul thing starts.
Gotcha. Yeah, that was sort of the impression that I got. Yeah, and I'm sure we'll make this point several times over, but initially, like, where it starts and how it is for quite a long time before you get to this more mystical stuff is, I mean, they're just doing science. Like, it's just early... early chemistry and everything.
It's metal. It's what we would today call metallurgy.
Right. Yeah.
They find these rocks and stones in the ground, and they realize mm-hmm. if you bash on them, or if you put them in a pot and heat them up and melt them, you can make stuff out of them.
Yeah. Exactly. And I guess I got to stick this in at least somewhere, because what in part gave me sort of a respect for alchemy and its role in history. And I think we actually talked about this before, because you do like history of science, and that's what the main character in these books does. But the Discovery of Witches books, it's like all about, like, she does like alchemical symbology and imagery and stuff. And so you get a lot of that right in the book, and yeah, all the stuff with that. So I will never stop recommending that book, especially when I get an episode about alchemy. Okay. So that's sort of what alchemy is. And you already alluded to this because you talked about India and China and where alchemy started. And that's sort of the point here, is it sort of starts all over. And it's my understanding that the exact roots are difficult to trace for a couple of reasons, because a lot of alchemy was purposefully, at least later on, shrouded in sort of mystery and secrecy. And we'll talk more about some of that symbology in a little while that people use to like keep things very mysterious.
Yeah, in the early days of what we might refer to as the golden age of alchemy, mm-hmm. there's all this very, you got to keep it quiet. It's a craft tradition, which means you learn as a student by working next to a master, and nothing is written down. And that will change mm-hmm. as time goes by, and they mm-hmm. start writing things down. And that's what will lead to this. The thing that most people think of when they think of alchemy are these incredibly illustrated books, manuscripts,
mm-hmm.
these sort of crazy mm-hmm. pictures of lions biting the sun, you know, and and talking skeletons. But that's going to come along a little bit later.
Yes. And then, as you mentioned, the practice of alchemy, you know, develops across several cultures. And it seems like it's unclear how much they influenced one another, if at all, like if there was some trade route action happening, or, you know, various cultures conquering others, like whether or not you get some of that exchange. But it might have just been that some of them developed these ideas separately.
Yeah, well, like everything else in history, it's incredibly complicated.
Yeah.
And what happens is the early centuries of the Common Era, along the Silk Road, coming out uh-huh. of China, coming out of Asia, You have all sorts of things, people, animals, ideas, physical objects. And it starts to pass from Asia into the West, especially at first into the Middle East, where Muslim scholars see this and realize there may very well be something to it, and they start working on it. Now, one of the questions that we discuss in my class is, you know, where does this word come from, alchemy? Where does the name come from? And there's a couple of different variations on this, but it's thought that the modern English word alchemy comes from Egypt because Egypt, you know, 3,000-4,000 BC was known as the Black Land because you have all this water and silt coming from Central Africa towards the Mediterranean, and it gets dumped into the plains of Egypt, which is why the Egyptian civilization grows, because now you have this place where you can grow a lot of food. A lot of food means a lot of people. Yeah. A lot of people means complex laws and governments and things. That's how they can manage to build pyramids, because they have big population with plenty of food to feed people. And so the word chemi is thought to mean the black earth, the black land or black dirt. And so that may be part of where that name comes from. And then it of course, that kind of collides with the Greek word kao, which is sort of the general smelting study of the structure of metals. And so it's going to sort of percolate through Hellenistic Greece and then into Islam, where they, of course, add the kind of definite article al to the kamaya. For those in the audience who don't know this, in Arabic, al is the equivalent of the, or al in Spanish, la in French. And so those two get put together, and alchemia, and then, of course, Europeans get a hold of it, and Europeans ruin everything they touch and twist it out of shape. So alchemia becomes alchemy and chemistry.
Yep. So it's like, even, you know, the origin of the name is very diverse.
It has this long travel from China, India. I always tell my students, if somebody asks you, where was this invented or where did that come from? And if you don't know, just say India or China. because you're probably right.
So that was like, so I guess I sort of got a couple different narratives about that. So you're like team, they get it from India and China.
Again, the people are thinking about smelting metal in the Middle East, in Islam, even in the Christian world, certainly in the classical world, the Greeks and the Romans were smelting metal. And so all that sort of gets, you know, dumped in the great big fat stew, and out comes alchemy.
Yeah. I had also read that Alexander the Great was potentially also very important, and the city of Alexandria, sort of prior to it becoming more of an Islamic practice. The Greeks sort of get it from the Egyptians, and Alexandria is very important. You lose some of those texts and knowledge when it's destroyed. It becomes more of an Islamic practice, and then the Crusades happen, and then it gets very popular in the late medieval and Renaissance periods.
Right. If you think of the world like a big wagon wheel, you have these spokes coming towards the center, and the spokes are coming, one spoke is coming out of China, and one spoke is coming out of India, and one spoke is coming out of Africa. And the hub of that wheel is the Islamic world. So all this stuff passes through. The Silk Road kind of squeezes down at that point and then becomes part of the old Roman highway system, which is already there. And so now you have this basically a super highway of information. And Alexander, he invades India around about the early 300s BC. And that also probably contributed to bringing these ideas west.
Yeah, right.
There's a huge impact of Greek learning to call any kind of science, medicine, technology that comes out of the Greek world. We call it Aristotelian after Aristotle.
Okay.
Which is misleading because it makes it appear as if Aristotle invents everything.
Right.
Somehow he had the better PR guy. And so he gets to take credit for everything. And so Aristotelian physics is the Greeks want to understand the universe. And they get to a point where they say, okay, the universe is extremely complex. How can we understand it? We understand it by simplifying everything, break everything down to its simplest parts, and that way you can understand how the universe is put together. And they put together the four elements, air, fire, earth, and water, along with the four humors, hot, dry, cold, and wet. And the basic idea there is that everything in the universe is made up of a combination of one or more of these elements. And so when Arab philosophers, Arab naturalists are also heavily influenced by Greek learning. And so what happens is, as alchemy is coming along, this is where the basic concept of the alchemy we would recognize as alchemy comes from, this basic understanding or this basic idea about the four elements. Because if you accept that everything is made up of basically a recipe of ingredients, these four ingredients, if you think that's correct, then logically you can change one thing into another by figuring out what the recipe is and then altering it. And so if lead, for example, you know, the classic alchemical idea, if lead has a recipe made up of a combination of air, fire, earth, and water, and gold is also made up of a combination of these things, if you can figure out exactly what the recipe is, you can change the one into the other.
Right. Which, like, at the time, knowing what they knew and
sure, it makes sense.
Not what we know today, like, it's not that crazy.
Well, we know now that we still have this notion that everything's made up of basic elements. Today, we know there's a lot more of them than four.
Right.
They just didn't have all the details, but they had the basic idea.
Yeah. It's like the beginning of, like, getting down to, like, the base of what are we made of and how are things made, which, you know, it's like we'll make the point several times. Like, it's just science. It's just trying to understand the world around you. Okay. So a couple of things of note. So, like, once we get things going in sort of the medieval and Renaissance in what we would call, I guess, Western alchemy, I thought it was really interesting to find out that people like Isaac Newton and Robert Boyle, who's like one of the fathers of chemistry, were also either alchemists or, like, at least very interested in alchemy.
We know now that both Newton and Boyle were alchemists.
And I guess just because alchemy sort of had, like, a negative connotation for a while, that was sort of a hidden thing. So we're going to jump ahead a little bit and then we'll come back to, like, the symbology and sort of more modern science stuff. But jumping ahead to, like, what you said, it was sort of dismissed as pseudoscience and we didn't take it seriously for a really long time up until, like, somewhat recently. And so I want to touch briefly on, like, the downfall of alchemy. So, like, we've developed alchemy, we've got this early science happening, people are trying to understand, you know, how to make different things, how to transform different things. It's in the late 17th and early 18th century, though, that chemistry starts to split from alchemy and become its own distinct thing. So it's abandoning the mystic and religious aspects for more scientific thinking and practices. And alchemy starts to be associated with fraud and, I guess, essentially becomes synonymous with only the gold making aspect of it. It looks like it was also hurt by the fact that it was banned at one point because the King of England didn't want his wealth and power undermined by the idea that, like, his gold had come from the transformation of cheap metals. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Everybody thinks that, oh, alchemy was banned because the church was afraid of witchcraft and demonology. That's while there were some clerics that said you shouldn't do this alchemy thing because, but mostly it was financial. You know, yeah. if you're a king or a prince or whatever, you don't want somebody suddenly being able to create virtually limitless amounts of gold, which is then going to get dumped on the economy and wreck the economy.
Right. So, you know, capitalism, I guess.
And there were plenty of fraudsters. Not every alchemist was a fraudster, but there were enough of them to give it a bad name. They came up with a number of ingenious methods by which you could, in public with people watching, you could seemingly change lead into gold.
Mm-hmm.
But it was, you know, it was basically just really good stage magic, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Pick a card, and you know, is this your card? You know, and pull a coin out from behind your ear, that kind of thing.
Yeah, and it sounded like there were sort of notable examples of, you know, people paying someone a lot of money who claimed like, "Oh, I know how to make the philosopher's stone," things like that. And then it's like, well,
as a alchemist, you could make a living by sort of attaching yourself, leech-like, to some high-ranking noble who's got a lot of money, and you say, "Oh, if you give me the money to set up my lab, and you know, so I can, so I'll make gold for you," and so they would do that, and string them along for a while, and just before it got a little too much, they would disappear.
Yeah, the fraud aspect, the financial aspect, the breaking away of chemistry as sort of its own distinct thing, despite, you know, very much sharing roots with alchemy, leads to its decline. And I mean, I think it takes a while to peter out, but, you know, I don't really think many people, if anyone, is practicing alchemy anymore.
Actually, you'd be surprised. There's still people out there who claim that they're alchemists and they're, you know, doing this.
Yeah.
And as you said before, historians today see like 1700, late 1600s, early 1700s as this moment that, like I said before, when all the stuff starts out, it's very practical. And then as time goes by, it gets this kind of mystical hermeticism aspect attached to it. But then around 1700, this sort of split takes place where the more practical aspects of what is being done splits off to become chemistry without the mystical stuff. And the mystical stuff never goes away. It just sort of goes off to the other side and becomes hermeticism and deals mostly with the kind of metaphysical, spiritual, mystical aspect, less on the practical, where the practical is less of the mystical, becomes chemistry.
Yeah. So here's my question for you that I think you'll have better insight into than I would. Well, as with all things in history, like you say, it's all very complicated. But you mentioned that with the alchemy that was happening in India and how it wasn't so focused on like achieving immortality because they already had this idea of reincarnation. So my question is, like, there seems to be a lot of this sort of like 14th to 16th or 16th to 18th century alchemy stuff that, you know, has this mystical aspect, has these religious aspects, but like, couldn't you argue, like, it seems like it doesn't jive, like, it doesn't match well with like Christian ideals, despite being practiced in those fields, because like, well, the whole idea is like, well, you're going to die, but like, you'll live an immortal life in heaven. So like, why would you want to have immortality on earth? Do you know what I'm asking?
Yeah.
Like, I guess I'm surprised that people weren't like, you know, being like, oh, you're an alchemist, like you're a witch, like you shouldn't want to achieve immortality on earth because you're going to get in heaven or whatever, you know?
Right. Well, there was some of that.
Okay.
There were people who shunned alchemists because of this sort of spiritual aspect, because if you believe that you can change lead into gold, then it makes sense, if you're transforming lead into gold, lead is the impure, gold is the pure. We now know today that it's a little more complicated than that, but But back then, right. You know, lead represents the impure, gold is the pure. Mm-hmm. The human soul is lead. It's the impure. And so what you're trying to do is to do all these machinations to turn the impure soul into the pure soul. And so ultimately what this is all about for some hermeticists, some alchemists, is trying to get closer to God. You can't get close to God unless you purify yourself.
Okay. Which in this case is like probably giving yourself severe heavy metal
poisoning. Oh yeah, I'm sure, you know, they all had lead poisoning. They're all drinking silver. And, you know,
I know.
Probably their teeth are all falling out and their hair's falling out.
I'm looking at all these recipes that include like, I mean, I know, you know, it, we have a long history of giving people substances medicinally that we should not have, but like so much of this is like in labs where they're working with, without modern PPE, with, you know, lead and mercury and
sulfur. None of those drop down plastic shields in the lab, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm sad that Paige isn't here for that reason, because I'm sure she'd have a lot of thoughts about lab safety during this time.
The, you know, the basic alchemist's laboratory, along with all that great glassware, a lot of which is still used, you have at least one furnace. And these weren't modern furnaces. These are, you know, basically made out of earthenware and stones and things, and they're open, and so, you know, they're burning all the stuff, they're melting all this stuff, and so the fumes are coming out, you know, and they're fainting all over the place, and, you know, drinking iodine and gold, all kinds of crap, and you know, we're poisoning themselves, and they're probably drinking some of this stuff too. One of the aspects of creating the Philosopher's Stone is the elixir of life. The panacea from the Greek goddess. So if you think you've created some sort of fluid, some sort of cocktail that will cure your disease or extend your life, what do? You drink it.
Right.
And of course, it has exactly the opposite effect.
Yeah, I'm sure like so many people ended up just outright killing themselves drinking things they shouldn't have.
History is complicated. The story of human progress is long, messy, and riddled with controversies big and small. On Conflicted, we dive headfirst into history's most infamous events and contentious figures. We try and untangle the good from the bad, the fact from the fiction, and the monsters from the misunderstood. Was Genghis Khan a murderous butcher or a civic pioneer? Did the Allied powers go too far in firebombing the German city of Dresden at the twilight of World War II? And how did the Marquis de Sade acquire such a sinister reputation? And was any of it true? These are just a few of the tough questions we wrestle with and investigate on Conflicted. So if you love history or just enjoy a good story, please join me, your host, Zach Cornwell, for a fascinating new topic each and every month. Conflicted, a history podcast, is available on Spotify, Apple, or wherever else you get your podcasts. I hope to see you soon.
Okay, so one of the other things here that potentially contributes to the downfall of alchemy is the fact that alchemical symbology and imagery and the writing that they did can seem like it's indecipherable.
Right.
And it's like a lot of it's really weird. And like, I think, I mean, I can see how you're like, oh, all these people were like drinking mercury and arsenic and then like leaving these insane notes behind. Like, we're not going to take this seriously.
Yeah.
Yes. So that brings us sort of like this to alchemical symbology, which I wanted to at least spend a couple minutes on. And I'm sure you have thoughts on as well. But again, there's this idea of like things have to be kept secret. Much of the imagery and writing was allegorical, making it hard to decipher. some examples that I came across. So like distillation could be represented by a dove or a swan flying upwards. Condensation, a dove or a swan, it's the same bird flying downwards. Nitric and hydrochloric acid, a green dragon devouring the sun. And I think the sun was a common symbol for right. gold. So that makes sense because nitric and hydrochloric acid together make aqua regia, which can dissolve gold and other precious metals. In the case of the philosopher's stone, there are steps to create it that could be represented by animals or other imagery. I don't know. Do you have any particular examples you want to mention?
Well, this whole thing about the imagery is referred to as deknomen. And you're right. It's initially, alchemy is this craft tradition. So nothing gets written down. You learn by watching the master. But then eventually they start writing stuff down. But that immediately brings up this problem. You know, this is where modern scientific notebooks comes from. You record everything you're doing so you can repeat it. And if you write it in plain language, you don't want some mo coming in and, you know, snatching up your book and running off with it so they can take all your work and then make the philosopher's stone and you're left high and dry. And so it becomes a kind of standard thing that instead of, for example, if you're working on doing this and you decide – the first step is to boil a gallon of water. If you write down in your book, boil a gallon of water, anybody can understand that. So what you might say instead is, step one, the doves fly at midnight. Which to, you know, anybody who is not an adept, that doesn't make any sense. But you know that the doves fly at midnight means boil a gallon of water.
Mm-hmm.
And then they take it even further. And eventually what starts happening is they stop using text altogether. And they use drawings, they use illustration. And so instead of writing the doves fly at midnight, you put a little drawing of a dove flying past the moon. And so again, if you're not an insider, if you're not an adept, you don't know what this little picture means.
Yeah.
And so that's a way of keeping things safe. One of my favorite alchemists is Abu Musa Jabir ibn Hayyan, early Islamic alchemist. He's not Arab. It's thought that he was Persian. And one of the issues we have that as a historian, and it's one of the things I teach my students, is that one of the issues we have with studying alchemy is so much is obscured.
Yeah.
Language doesn't mean what it means. Pictures don't mean what it means. And there are a number of famous alchemists like Jabir ibn Hayyan. We're not even sure if they were real people.
Yeah.
Well, maybe, but we don't know. And one of the great things about Jabir is he writes his alchemical textbooks in such obscure language. It took a long time to decipher them. They've all been deciphered now, but initially it took, you know, there were a lot of work to try to figure out what he's saying. And his obscure texts become so well known for their obscurity that to this day, when we find something which is hard to read or somebody's saying something that doesn't make sense, we call it gibberish. From Abu Musa Jabir ibn Hayyan, because he was renowned for these very complex ways that he was explaining what he was doing.
Yeah. And he's also the one who I think is the first to make or discover aqua regia.
He's also credited, not enough, I think, with coming up with the basic scientific method way before Francis Bacon.
Yeah. There you go.
He uses the word experiment. He says, if you're not experimenting, you're not going to learn anything.
Yeah. We talked about him when we did our like sort of general spooky chemistry episode as being like one of those really early practitioners of chemistry, like not even in an alchemical sense. So, yeah, he was a pretty cool dude. If he existed,
yeah, we're not sure.
Yeah.
And there's like a dozen books, you know, attributed to him. There's even books attributed to him that we think were written by somebody, not him, but masquerading as him. And again, we run into this all the time. Europeans mangle everyone's name. And so instead of saying Abu Musa Jibir ibn Hayyan correctly, it's really not that difficult. Mm-hmm. They start referring to him as Jibir.
Oh.
And when there's several texts out there that we think were written by someone impersonating Jibir. And so you have texts ascribed to Abu Musa Jibir ibn Hayyan. And then you have this sort of fake guy, Jibir. Mm-hmm. And then you have a fake of the fake, which is pseudo Jibir. And so, you as a historian, you have to kind of like wind your way through all these obscure texts and try to make sense out of things. And, it's not always as easy as we would think. It's a text. Mm-hmm. If you can read the language, you read the text. Now you know what they're saying. And not always.
Right. Yes. And your example of, the dove flies at midnight, or what was it? Was it a dove? I already forgot.
The doves fly at midnight.
The doves fly at midnight. No, it reminds me. I think I found just a list of allegorical stories. And one was like the allegory of John at the fountain, or Senda Vigisius's Enigma of the Sages. I read through some of them, and it's like, knowing that they are meant to like describe a process, a chemical process, it's like, okay, I can tell how like you would think, you can see that these are instructions for something, for making something, but yeah, they're kind of wild to read.
There's a whole realm of practical history that's become more and more popular recently, where you have historians of science trying to figure out what these people are saying by recreating the experiments. So if you can recreate this, we can see, oh, okay, when they mixed this and that, they got this over here. So that's what the doves fly at midnight means.
Right. So you read my mind, because I was going to point out that there is some really cool work that has been done or is being done by a chemist and science historian named Lawrence. Is it Principe. Just Principe, or is it Prince?
Friend of mine.
Okay. Awesome. by Lawrence Principe, to go through and decipher these alchemical texts and try to reproduce their experiments. And one that I saw mentioned in several articles is that he created a philosopher's tree, which is made by mixing specially prepared mercury and gold. I think the mercury has to be like distilled several times or something, and heating them in a closed flask where they will crystallize into a golden branching structure that looks like a tree.
Right. And it looks like it grows.
Yeah.
Alive.
Like you look like you're creating more gold than what you started with. So, yeah. So I'm sure it's very beautiful. But again, like, no thank you to working with a lot of mercury.
Yeah. You have to have good protective gear these days to work on.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm sure using, like, he's doing this under much safer lab conditions. But yeah, right. My whole job right now is like testing things for heavy metals. So I'm like reading all these things that they're working with and thinking, like, what is happening to you people? So that brings us to sort of my final topic that I wanted to cover, but just a little bit of an overview of how much of an influence it's had on modern science. And we've been talking about this the whole time, but importantly, many alchemists who were working were very skilled experimentalists, and we owe a lot in our modern life to their work. So I've got some examples. We've got key contributions to the fields of metalworking, including the production of steel and other metal alloys, the extraction of metals from ore. Like we mentioned, alchemists were discovering chemical elements. They were working to organize and symbolize them in useful, if not also sometimes very mysterious ways. Arsenic, for example, was discovered at least as early as the 13th century. And I saw references to like the discovery of things like phosphorus, and they're working with sulfur and mercury and naming these things and treating them as individual substances. The Chinese alchemists, which I thought was interesting because it seemed like what they were doing was more medicinally related, but they invented gunpowder. So I don't know what how that was medicinal, but it happened.
And paper.
And paper, yeah. They discovered a lot of inorganic acids and bases like sulfuric acid, hydrochloric acid. We mentioned aqua regia before, which again must have gotten them very excited because it can dissolve gold. So they probably thought like, man, we are really onto something here. They brought the concept of distillation, at least to Western Europe. So I guess every time we have a cocktail, we're going to thank an alchemist for that. And then just contributions to a whole slew of things from ceramics to inks to dyes to paints to cosmetics. Like the list goes on and on and on for like things that you can thank alchemy for. And I did want to point out as we were talking about, you know, people sort of disguising their notes and not wanting others to read them. Like so much of this, it's like, it's not gone from modern science. Like, people don't want to get scooped. People are very secretive sometimes with the lab work that they are doing. I can tell you from, like, personal experience, like, we scientists can be, like, a very superstitious bunch. Like, everybody, especially working in a lab environment, like, has little things that we do or, like, when we use a particular instrument that, like, make no rational sense, but they worked once and we got the results we wanted. So it's like, well, we're going to keep doing this forever. And yeah, and I wanted to point out, like, you know, there's all these things that we owe to alchemy and that alchemists may not have been aiming to, like, create some of these things or find some of these things. But like, that's the same with a lot of modern scientific discoveries. Like there are medicines that we have and use where it's like, we don't really understand the exact mechanism by which they work. We just know that they do and people take them. There have been modern scientific discoveries that have been accidents. Like for example, artificial sweeteners. People were working on completely different things. They forgot to wash their hands, like went to have a cigarette, went to eat their lunch, and like accidentally put their hand in their mouth. And we're like, wow, this tastes really sweet. And now we have artificial sweeteners.
Famously, penicillin discovered by accident.
Yeah, just mold on bread. So I don't know if there was anything specific that you wanted to add. I guess the one thing is I was able to find the website for the class that you teach and look at a few of the resources that you had on there. One of the things that stuck out to me was that you noted that sort of understanding the history of alchemy helps us to distinguish things like fake news and like what drives people to fall for it, like sort of, you know, the art of the grift, all that. What makes you say that specifically?
Yeah, well, that's one of these things that isn't often addressed that, you know, okay, yeah, it's interesting, it's fun, it's, you know, it's got angels and gold and wizards and all that.
Yeah.
But what can the study of alchemy give us today? And it's quite a bit outside even of the scientific, because there's a whole category of alchemists who were con artists. They knew they weren't actually doing this. They weren't trying to actually doing it. They were trying to trick people out of their money, trick people into believing these weird things, sometimes intentionally, sometimes not intentionally. You have John Dee, for example, famous British occultist working with this guy, Edward Kelly, who Kelly was a real grifter. John Dee usually gets let off the hook as simply naive, and that it was Edward Kelly who was the, you know, the fake news guy. They believe they were talking to angels. In fact, you can go into a bookstore today and buy paperback copies of, you know, the so-called conversations that they were having with angels. And people believe they were really doing this. And so if we look at that, we can see that this modern 21st century notion of fake news, grifting, lying, evil politicians, etc., has been around for a while. And we can see the stuff going on today is the same sort of thing that went on in the past.
Yeah.
And so that's why it's useful for us to look at this topic.
Yeah, right. Yeah, understand how people were doing it before so you can better recognize it today. Listen, though, they were working with all these heavy metals, though. Like, I'm not unconvinced that they didn't also think they were talking to angels.
And that may very well be the case. You know, a lot of medieval alchemy was beer making, you know, so you spend the day in the lab and you're making a nice 10% IPA. And the next thing you know, you're hearing voices.
Yeah. It could happen to anyone.
You don't even realize.
Okay. Well, I think that we're sort of at our hour mark. That sort of covers everything that I had written down and wanted to chat about. Do you have any sort of closing thoughts on alchemy that you think the world should know?
Well, I think we covered the high points.
Yeah. Yeah, like you said, it's a very long history. There's a lot here. There's so much fascinating stuff about, you know, particular alchemists who were working and the discoveries that they made and everything. So I definitely encourage people to look more into it.
And we didn't even really start to talk about Hermeticism. I mean, that's
right.
A whole other thing.
Yeah. One topic at a time. Well, I really appreciate you joining me. Yeah. I guess if people want to find you, you're still on Twitter or X.
Somebody hijacked my Twitter handle, whatever we call it.
Yeah, I remember that happened a while ago. So we'll have to update it.
I had almost 7,000 followers, so that's all gone. So I reconstituted myself. I was originally Tarbosaurus. Now I'm at Romeo A25, which was my call sign when I was in the service. My radio call sign was Romeo 25. If you want, you can go to my university webpage. Just Google my name, and you'll get my Kane University webpage. And you can see the classes I teach. You can see the books I use for the classes. You can see you can download the syllabus for my classes. There's all my books are there. All tons of articles and op-ed pieces that you can download for free.
Yeah. Yeah, and we will link to all of that in the show notes.
If you want to contact me by email to yell at me for something, I probably said something to...
No, it was all fine.
Well, I mean other people.
Yeah.
And you can just email me, and I usually, as long as you don't curse at me, I'll usually answer any kind of email.
Yeah. Sounds good. And I always say, I want to say Keene University. I pronounce
it's
it wrong
Kane,
every time.
Like walking
Kane
stick.
University. Yeah, next time
that's
I'm going to remember.
Everybody does that.
Yeah. All right. Well, I appreciate your time so much. This was great. That wraps up our episode on alchemy. Thank you again to Brian for joining us. Join us next time for episode 71 on the history of burial and funeral practices. If you liked this episode, hit subscribe and share with a friend. Check the show notes for links to all of our social media accounts, our Discord server, and Patreon. If you have any questions about previous topics or ideas for future episodes, email us at spookysciencesisters@gmail.com. As always, thank you for listening and stay spooky.
Spooky Science Sisters is a proud member of the Evergreen Podcasts Network. For more information or to check out other shows, please visit evergreenpodcasts.com.
Did you guys hear about that couple that went on vacation and one spouse murdered the other? In fact, the entire vacation was planned just so that they could make the murder look like an accident.
Ah, so like a slaycation.
Oh boy, sounds like a fun new true crime podcast to me.
On every episode of Slaycation, we'll examine true cases of people who were killed while on vacation.
Was it murder? Or just a horrible accident? That's up to you and the law to decide.
But either way, if you leave for your vacation in the plane... and come home under the plane, you've definitely gone on a slaycation.
Join us every week for a fascinating new episode.
911, what's your emergency?
But make sure to pack your body bags,
because getting away can be murder.
This is Slaycation.